You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network. I am your host, Joel Cherney. My guest today is film critic Glenn Kenny, author of the book Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas, published in 2020 by Hanover Square Press. 30 years ago, Goodfellas premiered in theaters and quickly became the gold standard for the modern gangster film. It also provided Martin Scorsese a new focus for his filmmaking. Based on Nicholas Pileggi's bestseller, Wise Guy, the movie was a tour de force presentation of crime and excess. Glenn's book is a complete overview of the movie, including many useful details that add immeasurably to the film. Welcome, Glenn Kenny. Hi, Glenn. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here. Thank you so much for asking.
I know this must be a busy time for you since your book, Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas, was just published this week as we are talking. Of course, it's also the 30th anniversary of Goodfellas that came out in 1990, obviously, so I'm looking forward to diving into the book. But I'd also like to talk a little bit about your background in film. I think we can use the word prolific to label your work. You currently write for the New York Times and RogerEbert.com. And you've written books about Star Wars and Robert De Niro. But when did you decide in life that film was going to be a career rather than a hobby and an obsession?
Actually, it was always an obsession. So, it didn't become a career until relatively late in my writing. Not late, but I began as a music critic. I was a rock critic. I wrote in the magazine Musician and the Village Voice for a long time. I wrote a notoriously dumb review of a Tribe Called Quest album for Rolling Stone that I'm still excoriated for on the internet whenever somebody comes upon it. I was mainly a music critic for a long time, and I started writing about film professionally in the mid-80s at a magazine called Video Review, where I worked from 1986 until about 1990-91. And that was an unusual magazine. I mean, nowadays, print being in the terrible state that it's in, the idea of magazines that thrive is almost foreign. And here in Video Review, here was a magazine that was a consumer magazine about home video hardware and software. It was not a trade publication, and yet it was a very sustainable and even profitable thing. And in 1990 or so, we were celebrating the magazine's 10th anniversary of publication. And I've been writing about Laserdisc film in the form of Laserdiscs and so on at Video Review for about 3 or so years. And that was really where I got my start writing about film as such. But also I wrote a lot about technology I wrote, the first review of the first 35-inch cathode ray tube television. The first home surround sound system created by Shure, which was, these three behemoth amplifiers with huge heat sinks that it took like 3 hours to assemble. So I had a lot of a technical background, and most of the technology that I wrote about is now completely obsolete. So that tech background is more or less useless. But I've been writing about film, and my publisher, the publisher of the magazine, wanted a lot of big names for our 10th anniversary issue. And, I commissioned work from Dave Barry. He was really great to work with. I tried to get Matt Groening to do a Life in Hell graphic about, VHS or something like that. Couldn't do that. And one person I approached was Martin Scorsese, because his film preservation efforts were starting to really accelerate at the time. And I wanted to have him write an essay about the importance of home video and the then inchoate idea of the home theater, how that was important to, cinephilia, the idea that you could actually have in your house your own film library, and why that was exciting and important. And at that time, in the winter of 1989, he was editing Goodfellas. So he didn't have time to sit down and write an essay. The idea was pitched, a fee was negotiated, and I was asked to go to Scorsese's office and speak with him for about an hour, and then draft up the notes into essay form, and then he'd sign off on it. So I did go up there, and he was in the midst of editing Goodfellas, which at the time was called Wise Guy, which was the title of Nick Kolegi's book upon which the film is based, a fantastic book, still a great read. And he was telling me about this picture. He said it was, he was hoping, even though it was going to be about 2.5 hours long, he predicted, it came in something like 220, 225, that it was going to be the most fast-paced film he'd ever done, because he was being very influenced, he said, by tabloid television documentaries. Inside Edition was just getting started at that time, as was stuff like Unsolved Mysteries, and also by The Untouchables, not the film that his friend Brian De Palma made, but rather the 50s television series with Robert Stack as Elliot Ness. Yeah. Robert Stack as Elliot Ness, and Robert Stack as the host of Unsolved Mysteries, is the bridge between The Untouchables and tabloid television. But he said those were influences on the film, but if you look at the film, the influences, you don't necessarily recognize those influences, because even that style of television has become kind of outmoded by now. But there was that speed, the momentum, the use of still photographs and montages, all of which is also a hallmark of French New Wave filmmaking, which was also very influential on Goodfellas. So, having been a Scorsese fan, I felt a connection to his films that was personal from the very start. But working with him on this essay while he was editing Goodfellas made me want to write about Goodfellas all the more. Now, after working at Video Review, I did not wrote about films in Entertainment Weekly as a freelancer, and I had a job at Stereo Review, and that was also more music-oriented. And eventually, one of my colleagues at Video Review, Jim Meggs, got hired to be editor-in-chief of Premiere. And he brought me on to work with him. He had me at first writing about tech again, but then he had me work with David Foster Wallace on his essay, David Lynch Keeps His Head. And that essay got nominated for a National Magazine Award, and I was brought on full time. And I wrote features mostly and did editing. And then in 1999, we determined that we were going to have a very proactive review section in Premiere. We had an essay every month contributed by Todd McCarthy of Variety, who was a great critic, but we didn't have a consistent roundup of new films, partially because Premiere was a monthly magazine and the lead time was such that we didn't feel like we could review them in a timely enough way. But we also had this, if we build it, they will come philosophy, that if we decided to start running a review section with anywhere from 3 to 9 reviews in a month, that studios would help us out, they'd give us access to films earlier than usual and so on. And that ended up working out pretty well, although it was pretty stressful for me, because I'd be the guy coming into the office on a Friday night at 8 o'clock to write up a review of, say, The Talented Mr. Ripley, that they were literally holding up the shipping of the magazine to put in at the last minute. So it was exciting too, though. It was a real Johnny Deadline kind of situation. So that kind of gave me my grounding as a film critic as such. And then I covered festivals and so on. And that went on for quite some time, from 1999 to 2008. In 2007, the print version of Premiere folded, and I made the mistake of staying on for a rather ill-conceived and ill-executed digital version of Premiere, which was one of the most miserable experiences. If the 8-9 years at Premiere, 12 years of Premiere proper, were one of the great experiences of my life, the 10 months at Premiere, the website was one of the worst, and it got worse when some new management came in. I'm not going to mention the guy's name, but the reason that Premiere is not available as a digital archive is because of these penny-pinching idiot people who were brought in, who just, you know, wrecked it, just wrecked stuff and left. Then I worked for a while at the Microsoft Networks website, doing regular reviews for them, and that was a lot of fun. And again, that was a weird situation when the Microsoft Network decided to stop putting original content on the website. Not only did they stop putting up new content, but they just wiped away everything that had been written. So I had, like, literally, I don't know, 3 to 4 years of work just wiped away. I still have the drafts in various computers, and that's fine. But it's a weird time to be published in the world of websites and stuff, because you just never know what's going to last or not. It's part of the reason I still maintain my blog, even though there's not a lot of actual blogging going on these days, because my work with Ebert.com and the New York Times keeps me very busy. But I just like to have a place where I can kind of like have a semi-permanent, you know, paid for venue for my work. That was my journey. And during my time at Premiere, I had a lot of interaction with Scorsese. We did, one of my favorite things at Premiere was doing a joint interview with Scorsese and Spike Lee, which was great. And then talking to Scorsese about various films. When Robert Mitchum and Jimmy Stewart died, he wrote an essay for us, an appreciation of them. So we had a lot of interaction on a lot of different levels, and that kind of fed into my being able to get access to him for this book.
Yeah, I found an interesting question and answer article on the Roger Ebert site from 2014, in which you were asked a bunch of questions related to film and things, and you told this wonderful story about going to see Frenzy in 1972 with a relative. Because
my grandmother,
your grandmother, because at the time you obviously were underage. You and I are close in age, but I think I'm a little older than you, and enough that I remember Video Review quite well, as I remember Stereo Review quite well. I subscribed to
both. Video Review was a fun magazine. It was a fun magazine to read, especially if you were inclined towards that sort of stuff. And it was a fun place to work, despite the guy who ran it being a rather mercurial and temperamental figure, and being underpaid, of course, which is the constant lament of people in our situation. But Video Review is a fun magazine. I could see, if I was someone who was just a reader, how much I'd look forward to it every month.
Oh, yes, I definitely did. Because I, at the time, obviously, this was one of the few ways you could really keep up, because obviously no online. So if you weren't getting it in your newspaper, you had to find magazines or other formats to, and that's why, like I say, I read Video Review, Stereo Review. I remember Premiere Magazine very fondly, but so all of those are, I'm sure I read your writing and I just never knew it was you, so to speak. So in 72, we obviously know that you snuck in to see, you didn't sneak in, but you went to see Frenzy.
I didn't sneak in. This is the terrifying thing, you know. I hadn't yet had my growth spurt, which shot me up to 6'3" at the age of 14 and enabled me to start going to R-rated movies with complete impunity. The two films that prior to that were very important for me to see were Slaughterhouse-Five and Frenzy. Slaughterhouse-Five because I had read the book and I loved the book. Yeah, I was kind of a precocious autodidact child in terms of reading and film. And I had an uncle who was only about 10 or 15 years older than me. He took me to see that, and that was fine because, you know, he appreciated, you know, he didn't nudge me or anything like that, but he was fine rolling with the nudity of Valerie Perrine as Montana Wild Hack. But Frenzy was something wholly other because I very much wanted to see it. It had been talked about as being a huge comeback for Hitchcock, whose prior films, including Topaz, were not terribly well received. So, you know, it seemed exciting and interesting and grisly and all sorts of cool stuff. And my parents were at the time kind of fed up with indulging my film Jones on a regular basis. So, yeah, you want to see that movie? Go ask your grandmother. So I asked my grandmother, who was very much like, oh, yes, Alfred Hitchcock, you made Rebecca. So off we go. And, you know, one thing I'd love to write about, and I'm thinking about pitching this as my next book. I'd love to write about how the old school Hollywood directors like Preminger, Wyler, Hitchcock, and others handled the new freedoms that came their way once the production code dissolved. And I know that, you know, Preminger, of course, was someone who was actively lobbying for the production code to go away. But even he, at the point that it happened, kind of went a little wobbly, arguably, although, you know, these are films I admire to a certain extent for their conviction and daring. But, you know, some would argue he went extremely wobbly with something like Skidoo, the Jackie Gleason on LSD movie. Certainly a lot of people could argue that with Frenzy, Hitchcock took all of his weird sexual predilections, peccadilloes, and obsessions, and, you know, instead of making them subtext, made them text. And so you have the strangler character just sort of drooling over the breasts of the woman he's raping and strangling. And it's a shocking, lurid image, and it's terrifying and awful. And I'm sitting there with my grandmother, and there we are. And that was that. And that was maybe one of the most awkward but very, very quiet rides home from the movies that I ever experienced.
I think people have had similar. I know one. I luckily never had an experience like that, but I do have experiences sitting in a room with my mother watching video recordings of movies that I never would have seen with her if I had had any chance at all. So I understand that story.
Yeah, I was a little embarrassed seeing Raging Bull with my own mother at the age of 20, frankly. You know, she liked the movie. We weren't scandalized by it, but every now and then I was like, then once my growth spurt happened, I was just able to walk right in. But my friends and I didn't use our latitude or our ability to fool people to get into, you know, overtly dirty movies. We were cinephiles, so we would go see, you know, Chinatown and Blazing Saddles and yeah, the Dirty Harry films for sure. But we weren't going to see, you know, Grindhouse stuff. That came later. I think as a high schooler, you had that rite of passage that your knucklehead friends and you go see something at a porno theater. And that definitely happened. But that was around the time I was 17 and I'd moved to Wayne, where porno theaters were rampant, not rampant, but easily accessible. There was a former Jerry Lewis. Remember when Jerry Lewis had his own franchise of movie theaters that showed only family fare? So there was in Wayne, there was a strip mall and they had a Jerry Lewis cinema, and it went out of business. And as soon as it went out of business, it was converted into a porno theater. And that's where I saw Around the World with John Holmes. I won't use his stage name. It's a little vulgar, but yeah. And that's the thing that makes high school kids experience a lot of feelings. We were mostly cinephiles. So yeah, it was all about seeing Chinatown, not about anything else.
One of the things I remember the most about Frenzy at the time, and this may be apocryphal, but I'm going to say it anyway, was what I had read is the original plan for Alfred Hitchcock's cameo was that he was going to be a body floating down the water when they're pulling somebody out of the water. But I don't know if that one's actually, it wasn't what the cameo ended up being.
I had heard that too, but I don't think he was in any kind of shape to do that kind of stunt work.
So I guess my question is, obviously another famous movie came out in 1972, and that was The Godfather. How long before you got a chance to see that?
I think I saw it relatively early on, maybe 2 or 3 years after it first came out. I mean, it played a long time. The funny thing is, when the book came out, I was in grade school, and everybody was passing around this dog-eared mass market paperback of the book, around fifth grade or so, with the dog-eared pages having to do with Sonny, seducing in his own, bon vivant way, one of the bridesmaids at Connie's wedding. And the verb thrust was used quite frequently. And this was, something that kids, they'd stole their parents' copy of The Godfather and brought it to school and passed it around, and everybody was sort of scandalized and confused because you don't know, your knowledge as a fifth grader about how to do sex is, of course, rightly limited. But the kids were curious anyway. So even as the kids were passing around this book and reading the dirty parts, I was like, this isn't really what the book's about, is it? I mean, I didn't, make a point of being a pedant about it, but it's sort of like, kind of missing the point. And then when the film came out, the scene is there, but it's definitely truncated, and it's not the point. The point is something wholly other. And a lot of the things about that movie that were very groundbreaking, including the violence. I mean, if even though we'd seen The Wild Bunch, the shooting of Sonny at the toll booth is still kind of so over the top and so brutal that it goes into a whole other category. But I did make a point of seeing that as we made a point of seeing Mean Streets. When we saw Mean Streets, which was not Scorsese's first feature, but definitely his first really personal feature, his first feature to be made almost entirely in his own voice. I saw it with a friend, and we're watching it, and there's that opening. And as someone who's Italian American, my mother's people were from Naples, and my friend was Italian American, and we were Jersey born and raised. We're watching this film, and there's that drum beat of "Be My Baby," accompanied by the home movies at the beginning, the opening credits, and Little Lily, and my friend and I are looking at each other. Even at the age of 13, we're like, "Hey, this guy gets it." That's how I became a Scorsese fan.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question, actually, is when was he on your personal radar? Obviously, we know now that it was by Mean Streets. Scorsese's career has its ups and downs, but there's no question that I was recently talking to Eric San Juan, who wrote a book about the films of Martin Scorsese, and we talked a lot about Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, since that's one of his early ones. Mm-hmm. And most people probably wouldn't think of them. The average person today would never occur to them that he might have had anything to do with that film unless they're reasonably well-versed in film. So
Before I read the book, I made sure that I reread, I purposely to prepare, I wanted it because it had been a while. I went back and reread Pileggi's book, Wise Guys, and then also rewatched the films. Let's talk about Pileggi's book as the starting point, because I do feel like Scorsese does a pretty good job of following it. He doesn't get too far off. Obviously, he edits it down, but one of the things I noted from reading the book was that the book is told from a lot of different perspectives, mostly Henry Hill's, but his wife talks to in the book, and I noticed that Scorsese used that same technique in the film where Henry Hill obviously narrates most of the film, but every once in a while, Karen would come in with her statements and such, and I found that to be an interesting way to use Pileggi's book as part of the film. How involved was Pileggi in the making of Goodfellas?
He was involved up to a point, and then he wasn't involved because he tells the story in my book about how he got a call from Scorsese. Scorsese was so excited about Wise Guy that he actually, his personal assistant found Pileggi's home phone number and he called Pileggi at home. He called Pileggi at the office of New York and he left a message. And Pileggi thought that it was his buddy David Denby, the film critic for New York magazine at the time, doing a prank call on him. So he didn't return the call. And then the call happened again. So he kept thinking it's Pileggi, that it's Denby. And then Nora Ephron, his wife, is saying to him, "Schmuck, why aren't you answering Martin Scorsese's call?" And Pileggi says, "No, that's not Martin Scorsese's call. You know, it's Denby. He's busting my balls. This is nonsense." And then Nora's like, "No, someone who's a script supervisor on Color of Money who's worked on one of my films got in touch with me and says, Marty wants to know why you're not answering his call." And Pileggi's like, "Uh-oh." So once that happened, they immediately connected. And Pileggi had been a fan of Scorsese's pictures. He wasn't thinking at the time too much in terms of making the film and the book into a film, but certainly the people who represented him were very keen on it. And he had it in his mind to an extent that, you know, once Scorsese expressed interest, he felt like it was a dream come true because he thought, well, this is the guy to make this film. This guy knows this world because he'd seen Mean Streets. He was very taken with Scorsese's documentary about his parents and about the Little Italy neighborhood he grew up in called Italian American. So he's like, yeah, this is the guy. As a result, he was very accommodating to Scorsese because Scorsese wanted to do the film, but he also needed to complete Last Temptation of Christ, a passion project he'd been working on for years that was supposed to go into production with Paramount in the early 80s. And then Barry Diller, Tower of Jello and destroyer of culture who lives to this day to destroy culture, pulled the plug on it because he wanted to avoid controversy. Then Universal came around and said, "We'll set it up for you," because Mike Ovitz, the super agent at CAA, put all the elements together. But he had to do that. Became a now or never thing. So not only he said to Pileggi, "Let's write the script," but then I got to take a year and I got to go make Last Temptation. And Pileggi said, yes. I mean, Pileggi really put his foot down. You know, other people were circling the property. Brian De Palma was expressed interest. And he said, you know, "I like Brian personally. I like his films a lot. But this is not a film. This is not a De Palma film. This is a Scorsese film." He was absolutely right. So then they wrote the script together. And after they wrote the script together, frankly, Pileggi, dropped out. He didn't drop out, but he doesn't, I asked him, a lot of the times writers like to be on the set. A lot of the times a writer will ask to be given a cameo in the movie, this, that, and the other thing. You know, I asked about the possibility of doing a cameo in the movie, and he shook his head like that was nonsense. That wasn't his place in life, the world, anywhere. And, you know, that he'd be available for rewrites, but never actually on the set. He'd stay at a hotel. He'd have a hotel room somewhere close to where the shoot was. And if there was a rewrite needed or some consultation needed, he'd be driven out there or someone would come to him and they'd talk it over. You know, he talks about how one of the most famous scenes in the movie that he's often complimented for is one that he had nothing to do with writing, which is the scene at the Bamboo Lounge where Tommy puts Henry through the whole inquisition of how am I funny? And that scene was improvised. It wasn't improvised on set, but it was talked through with Joe Pesci and Martin Scorsese. It wasn't in the finished script, but it was rehearsed and laid out. And, you know, the Warner execs who were on the set that day were a little upset about that, because they're like, this isn't in the script. What are you doing? Even though it's a classic scene. But Pileggi is a smart guy. And he also knows this world. And he knows that even if that story didn't happen in Wise Guy, that it's definitely a story that could happen in the world of those characters. And it is a story that happened in Joe Pesci's world when he was doing the nightclub circuit in Jersey. And the nightclub circuit in Jersey through the 50s and 60s was mobbed up to the max, you know, as you can read about in Nick Tosh's biography of Dean Martin. The whole circuit from Cleveland to, you know, New York was just completely mobbed up. So
good old Shonda Burns, you know, in Cleveland.
Right.
I still remember the day he was blown up in front of the theatrical. I know exactly where the theatrical was. I used to work near there, and it's just like that was the place in Cleveland where the mob hung out.
Yeah, it's amazing. So he knew that, and he knew well enough to say, "Yeah, do it. Let's do it." And So he gets credit for it. He says, I had nothing to do with writing it, but, you know, he'll roll with it. But he knows that, you know, these things are all the contributions of the people who are invested in this movie making and who really care about getting it right and who want to bring their, experience to it. That he keeps his distance and lets him make the film. And, I think he had a similar attitude when doing Casino, you know, which he co-wrote the script with Scorsese on that as well. Very much involved and very much also knowing when to say, I'm not going to be a diva and protest this, because they're doing it to make the film as vivid and true as possible.
So then you get into, after you discuss Wise Guys, you then start to talk about pre-production of the film. And one of the things that jumped off the page to me was the discussion of casting. And the one that I think, and you have to remember how big he was at the time, but the concept of Tom Cruise as Henry Hill. I think that is one that I'm not sure what would have happened there. What kind of issues did Scorsese have issues, though, in assembling the actors he wanted?
There are different stories about it. And, I was just talking with some people online about, wasn't John Malkovich offered the part of Jimmy Burke, as he was known then, was his real name, or Jimmy Conway? I think, you know, he worked with Ellen Lewis as the casting director for the first time, and Ellen Lewis had come over from an agency that he had been working with, and she struck out on her own. So this was her first big movie. They put out a lot of calls, and the casting of the supporting players was very involved, and they saw lots and lots of headshots, lots and lots of people, lots of video auditions. But someone was saying, wasn't John Malkovich offered this part? I'm like, people talk about how that happened. It's not in my interviews with Erwin Winkler and Scorsese and Robert De Niro, Malkovich doesn't come up. But people like to talk about it. Well, wouldn't it have been interesting if Malkovich had been in the film? I'm like, well, I don't think, even if it was discussed, I don't think it would have happened because I don't think it would have been interesting. You know, I don't think it would have been good. I mean, Malkovich is a Russian gangster. Yeah, that makes sense. Malkovich is an Irish gangster. Not so much. And in the film, in the book, I talk about two movies that were made about Lufthansa heist, in which the character of Jimmy Burke is played by, in one film, John Mahoney of Frasier fame, and in another film by Donald Sutherland. And in the film with Donald Sutherland, he plays Jimmy, his real name was Jimmy Burke, and in Goodfellas, the name was changed to Jimmy Conway because Jimmy Burke's daughter wanted $100,000 for the use of the Burke name. So as a result, they changed all the names down the line. Paul Vario became Paulie Cicero. Marty became Maury, in the film with Donald Sutherland, he plays Jimmy Burke with an Irish accent, which is super weird because Jimmy Burke was raised in New York City. He wasn't Irish, but you know, the thing is you have to get over the anxiety of influence with De Niro. And I guess a way to do that is just completely go gonzo. It didn't concern me too much to talk about, oh, well, they might have cast such and such and so, you know, it was part of the idea was that, you know, for Scorsese, I think it made sense to have two relative unknowns play Henry Hill and Karen Hill because they're as characters in a gangster movie, they're new types of characters. The idea of this told from a mafia foot soldier point of view. And remember that except for the scheme is almost like casting Brando in The Godfather, because except for Brando in The Godfather, almost all of the supporting cast are new people who weren't that famous at the time. Diane Keaton wasn't famous. Al Pacino wasn't famous. Duvall was a known figure in film for many years, but he was a supporting character actor who played a lot of different parts. He wasn't a known name. James Caan wasn't that well known. John Cazale, all these kind of relative unknowns playing this fresh approach to a crime movie, because all the other mafia movies, not that there were a whole hell of a lot of them, but almost all the other mafia movies made prior to that, except for the B movies, like the Brothers Rico with Richard Conte and stuff like that, were movies that had like completely inapposite cast, like Martin Ritz, The Brotherhood with Kirk Douglas as a Sicilian Don. One reason people thought The Godfather would never work is because films like The Brotherhood bombed. And the reason they bombed, or one reason they bombed, is because they were absurd, you know? So Coppola's coup in casting, I mean, obviously James Caan is Jewish, he's not Italian. And you know, there's all sorts of, ways that the ethnicity of the cast doesn't line up with the ethnicity of the characters, but the types and the looks are much more authentic in The Godfather. And it's one huge legendary star with a cast of people who aren't as well known. And in a way, that's one way that Goodfellas follows the dynamic of The Godfather. You can talk all you want about who may or may not have been offered or considered for the role of Jimmy Conway. But the fact that De Niro is Jimmy Conway in the finished film is really the salient and most important factor of it. And I mean, I think Pileggi really assumed that if Scorsese was going to make a film of Wise Guy, that De Niro would be involved in it somehow. And what happened was De Niro read the book, I think, before he read the script, and he noticed right away that the way the Henry Hill character plays in the move in the book, he's mostly, you know, it's mostly in his young adult years. And he thought, well, I'm too old now to do Henry, but hey, I'm just the right age to do one of Henry's mentors. And that would be Jimmy Conway. So that was one of those things that just, you know, you look at it now and it seems predestined and kind of perfect. So I don't even want to talk about who was talked about. There's an example that Irwin Winkler brings up in my interview with him that he had brought up before, and that's in his wonderful book, A Life in Movies. that Terry Semel and somebody else at Warner Brothers had pitched Tom Cruise and Henry Hill, Tom Cruise to play Henry Hill and Madonna to play Karen Hill. And, you know, Scorsese had worked with Tom Cruise in Color of Money, and they had a productive working relationship. And I think Cruise did a great job as a performer in that film. But Winkler, looking back, says, no, Cruise was entirely wrong at that time in his career to play Henry Hill. Can you see, he says to me, can you see Tom Cruise going crazy on cocaine in a movie at that time? I'm like, yeah. I mean, he did things that seemed unusual for him. But, you know, I would be inclined to agree with Winkler there. And then about Madonna, he wouldn't even countenance it. So, you know, to have that cast, you know, and to bring Pesci back as well, I just, you know, it's one of those, Scorsese is very good with casting. And you see in his films, people who have very small but important roles, and they go on to do amazing things, like Forrest Whitaker in The Color of Money as this pool player who hustles Paul Newman's character. That's one of the great, like, little supporting bits in the history of movie. It's right up there with, you know, Mickey Rourke and Body Heat. You know, you just look at this guy, and it's this combination of a charisma and talent, and you go, whoa, this guy's going to be a huge star. And he finds those people. In this film, you have Isaiah Whitlock, Welker White, these character actors who do such great work and are just incredibly reliable.
So, during the production process, obviously you spend a lot of time talking about the production process, but then you go literally two chapters that I think basically present an overview of the film. First one, literally the whole film start to finish visually, but then you talk about the music, and that's important because obviously one of the things that we hear a lot about Scorsese is his, especially recent, you know, in nowadays, is his use of popular music for his soundtracks. Many of his films, he doesn't even have anything else for soundtracks. The entire soundtrack is the pop songs that he uses. What kind of information did you find as far as, number one, were many of the songs ones that he had planned all along, or was there a large amount of time that he had to spend deciding where he was going to use what song, including having to get the rights for them?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. And the rights were complicated and kind of expensive for the time. Goodfellas is one of those films that made getting rights even more expensive than it was at the time, by the way. But Barbara DeFina, who is married to Scorsese and is a credited executive producer on Goodfellas, told me that when they were, you know, that he was thinking about the music for what was then Wise Guy and became Goodfellas for a long time. She said while they were in Morocco working on Last Temptation of Christ, that's when Scorsese came up with the idea of using the Sex Pistols' Sid Vicious cover of My Way for the closing credits. And even as far back as writing the script, Pileggi tells the story in some documentaries, and they also told me the story. It's in the opening chapter with Pileggi that he's the very scene that the song appears in when Jimmy Conway is thinking about killing Maury. He told Pileggi, write down cream. And Pileggi's thinking, what cream? Dairy product? Because Pileggi wasn't a rock and roll guy. He was a, you know, Bennett, Sinatra, Jimmy Roselli guy, just like the mobsters were. But he writes down cream in the margin anyway, because, you know, he's the typewriter and he's supposed to be the director. It was only a couple of years later when the film comes out, he's like, oh, Cream, this song, Sunshine of Your Love, which, you know, was dismissed at the time of its recording by Jerry Wexler, the great record producer, as psychedelic hogwash. And Scorsese rationalizes it, well, you know, gangsters didn't listen to psychedelic rock at that time, but he's in a bar, the bar has a jukebox, and the jukebox probably has this song on it. So that's the rationale. You know, a lot of the times in the film, especially in the May 11th scene, the music functions as a kind of a consciousness of its own that unites the consciousness of Scorsese and his sensibility to the consciousness of Henry Hill and his frantic state while he's running around trying to, you know, give away guns, make dinner, and arrange for a drug trafficking event.
All while watching for a plane, watching a helicopter over his head constantly.
Yeah, yeah. And when the helicopter, he looks over his head and he just sees blue sky, he doesn't see a helicopter. That 1 minute, then Muddy Waters comes in and says, everything going to be all right this morning. And that's a snippet from Mannish Boy, and it's just that one snippet. And then it cuts off, and it goes into What Is Life by George Harrison. But then Mannish Boy comes back with its irrepressible stump. And that's, you know, as the day is getting more difficult, you know, so it's the rhythm of what's going on in the frame, and it's the information that the head of the character is processing, and several other dimensions. It's really very masterful, I think, in that scene, and throughout Goodfellas. You know, he's orchestrating the vision and the sound in a way that's absolute genius.
So one of the things that you talk about, because it shows that you were able to interview a large number of people for the book, and also probably from past interviews they've done. One of the things I found interesting was Robert De Niro's, how he prepared for the role, and you gave some of the background of some of the information that he would write down as far as keep track of while he was preparing.
Yeah, he's an actor who constructs his characters from the outside in. You know, he's very misunderstood. A lot of people talk about his relation to the method, but a lot of people don't understand what the method is. I don't, you know, my friend Isaac Butler is in the middle of writing a book about method acting that I think is going to really clear things up, but that won't be out for a while. But, you know, the method as defined by Stanislavski, you know, has to do with psychology and motivation. Who is my character? Why is he here? And it's mostly thinking it through from the inside out. But with De Niro, he does it from the outside in, because it's all about the character's appearance. You know, what he's wearing, how his hair is styled, the jewelry he has on, the ring he has on, the watch he has on, all of that stuff. And that has been part of the way he prepares for roles from the very beginning. When he was a young actor in New York struggling, his headshot was not a single headshot. It was a page with 8 different shots of him in 8 different costumes, including, you know, a 19th century style Russian with a Van Dyke beard, to a New York City taxi driver. And that, you know, De Niro's notes are all about what Jimmy wears and how Jimmy conducts himself in social interactions. Not, you know, does Jimmy kill without remorse? Does Jimmy have feelings? Does Jimmy do this? Does Jimmy do that? It's about presentation. And that's his way into the character.
The other thing, besides, after you talk about the films itself, obviously you then discuss editing and post-production and then, of course, release. But the one chapter that I found very illuminating, even though I knew some of the storyline, was what actually happened to Henry Hill at the end, you know, his eventual downfall. Obviously, the film, when the film ended, that was where he was. I mean, it was 1989 when the film was being made, 1990 in that period. So obviously that information in the film was correct. But we know now that the rest of his life did not exactly end particularly well.
No, and, you know, he is kind of a victim of his own appetites. You know, Henry was in real life, the real life Henry Hill. I remember going to see Edward MacDonald, who plays himself in the movie and who was the prosecutor who helped set Henry Hill up in witness protection. The first thing Edward said to me was, Henry is a schmuck. You know, MacDonald's opinion of Henry was he wasn't very good as a gangster. And I think Nick Pileggi echoes that to a certain extent. But Henry was the court jester of his crew. He was well-liked, and he was entertaining. And even when he got nabbed, he was entertaining for the cops that he was working with to get evidence against the people he used to be involved with. You know, he'd make dinner. He was a very avid and enthusiastic and good chef. So he always liked being the center of attention. And part of the reason I think that he approached Pileggi in the first place was because he missed the life once he was out of it. And his way of re-experiencing it was to relive it. And he hated witness protection. He hated that anonymity, even though he knew that breaking that anonymity was going to possibly get him killed. So once, you know, and he had been bristling against witness protection since, you know, he got in witness protection in 80. According to Greg Hill, he got out in 84, although some say, you know, it was later than that, but Greg was his son, so he would probably know. And then once Goodfellas came out, you know, I think the fact that, you know, these other people who were real celebrities were getting this celebrity based on his life, I mean, it didn't drive him homicidally crazy, but he thought, well, why can't I get in on this? And that's when he kind of really, and between that and separating from Karen Hill, which, you know, didn't take all that long, he started appearing out in public more. He started writing books. He wrote he bounced around trying to outrun the mobsters he thought were after him. He spent some time in the Midwest, but, you know, after Goodfellas, he was a Hollywood guy. He was an LA guy, and he wanted to be involved in that world. And he wrote actually a pretty good cookbook. I used some of the recipes, and it actually does contain the famous favorite of his brother Michael, the ziti with meat sauce, which needs to be stirred for 4 hours. And I actually made that at home, and my wife called it life changing. So it's a good recipe.
Better than the recipe that Pauly did in The Godfather, which everybody made fun of.
Yeah, the Clemenza's tomato sauce recipe, which isn't as good. Clemenza. It's not as good as Henry's ziti with meat sauce recipe. It's close, though. I mean, you know, I like, you know, the slicing garlic, all that other stuff. You know, it's very interesting. But Henry was also, he was starved for attention. He felt more remorse about selling out his friends than he felt about any of the violent crimes he committed. So he became a rather sad alcoholic. And being an alcoholic in that kind of public life creates some pretty sad results, some of which are documented by Howard Stern on his radio show and also transcribed in his recent book, Coming Clean, that Henry would call in drunk. And
oh, yeah, I remember Henry Hill. I remember Henry Hill's calls to Howard Stern quite well, including the laugh he had. I mean, it was just like you could tell this was somebody who was an absolute mess.
Yeah, that kind of maniacal laugh. He said to Edward McDonald near the end of his life, you're my best friend. And Edward McDonald was like, thanks, but I don't really know what to say to that because, it wasn't as if Henry was his best friend. He had a rich and varied social life of which Henry was an unusual part. There's a story in the book of Henry wanting to go to Smith and Walensky's, a steakhouse where Edward McDonald was a regular and would still be a regular if it were, you know, open right now. Leaving Denver, Colorado, or wherever he was coming in from without bringing his false teeth with him. And, you know, getting the Smith and Walensky's and not being able to eat anything with cream spinach and being so bombed that the owner wants him thrown out. So it's a sad thing. And, he would call Edward McDonald from sitting on the pier at Santa Monica wanting to jump off, you know? So there's a whole chapter in the book about that.
Right. So then, of course, in the last chapter, you did write a concluding chapter that more or less, with a quick overview of Scorsese from Goodfellas right up through The Irishman, which of course is his most recent film that's out about Jimmy Hoffa, that quite frankly in many ways mirrors Goodfellas in some ways. What did you think of?
I think it's a completion. I was very relieved when I saw it, and I liked it as much as I did, because while I was writing the book, the film was being edited. That's part of the reason I didn't get to interview Scorsese until March 9th of 2020, which is about 6 days before my manuscript was due, because he was so busy working on The Irishman. And then, then New York City shut down 2 days after I interviewed him. So that was pretty hair-raising. And the interview, I think, is really good, because I actually got him in kind of a preoccupied mood. So he was unusually frank and unusually, he's usually pretty frank, but, you know, he just kind of went to town on the idea that anybody might have that filmmaking is an easy thing for him. Since every movie since Raging Bull has been a knockdown, drag-out fight. But The Irishman, he had talked about Mean Streets, Goodfellas, and Casino being his gangster trilogy, even though The Departed is a film that has a strong crime element, and there's a certain crime element in Raging Bull. For him, Mean Streets, Goodfellas, and Casino are a real thread running from Little Italy to Queens all the way out to Las Vegas. And he said to Richard Schickel, you know, that's it. That's my last gangster film, meaning Casino, not The Departed, which I think Scorsese saw more as a police film than a gangster film. But I think Irishman makes it into a quartet, because the thread is very definite. And Frank Sheeran, the main character of The Irishman, played by Robert De Niro, is very different from Henry Hill. He's the same kind of operative for the mob. He's a foot soldier, but he takes it seriously to a fault in a way that's kind of dumb. And he doesn't realize, he thinks he's doing the right thing because he's following these orders from these people who are very good to him, but he has no sense of morality because he was taught to kill in the army, and he feels that killing is still a way to do things. And it's only at the end of his life, when he just starts to get an inkling of what he's done wrong, and when he talks to one of his daughters and he says, I was just trying to protect you. And the daughter says, protect us from what? And he's this cipher who, you know, doesn't realize that he's lost his soul, because he never really knew he had a soul in the first place. It's a very sobering contrast to the joyous amorality that Henry Hill indulges in and aspires to in Goodfellas.
The book that The Irishman is based on, it's come out a few times, but the most recent edition, which I think they put The Irishman on the cover now, has a lot of extra chapters in which the author is able to update, because obviously when the book was first finished, there were a lot of things that he didn't put in because he couldn't verify. And one of the things that comes out to me so interesting is that the Sheeran character eventually over time says, I'm not going to talk about anybody unless I know it's okay. And just towards the end, he finally, at least it's his point of view as to what actually happened.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's a very different book than Wise Guy. I think it's put together in a much different way. And, Scorsese and Steve Zalian took great cautions in terms of adapting it, not to make it so much about, you know, these spectacular revelations about Kennedy and Hoffa, but about the character. I think the figure of Hoffa as such is peripheral to the figure of Sheeran as this guy who, kills his best friend.
Yeah, there's a lot more in the book about...
And has to live with it.
Right. There's more in the book about the Kennedy stuff, but as you say, it's still his point of view. And but it's once again, I mean, you know, some authors, some filmmakers like working original material, some filmmakers do a combination, but It's interesting to see how Scorsese consistently seems to be able to find interesting sources, many of which are already very good, and create something new with them.
That's for sure.
Well, obviously the book has a lot more into it. I think it's just such a great overview. There have been many books about the making of famous films, but there's no question that I found Made Men to be one of the best. I really appreciate that you were able to talk to me about it. Obviously, there's a lot more we could have talked about, but I think this is a good point to sort of sum it up and say people, hopefully, as they rewatch the film now, given on the 30th anniversary and everything, that they make sure that they take the time to read your book as well.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you, Glenn.
You bet.
My thanks to Glenn Kenny. I think his book will be an important part of Scorsese literature. This is Joel Cherney, and I will be back soon with more New Books in Film, a podcast series on the New Books Network.